Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The fine-tuning argument, it's such a bad argument for God, because it looks like you're saying God had to fine-tune this number to one part in 120 so that his beautiful creation could exist. But my point is, God could have made it zero, which is the sensible value, and we could exist and everything could be better. So God's a pretty crummy architect if he chose this ridiculous value when zero would have made everyone happier and we would all be living longer and there'd be a lot more life in the universe. So the argument that ridiculous value points to an intelligent designer is ridiculous. It points to a pretty unintelligent designer.
Hello, this is Robinson Earhart here with the introduction to Robinson's podcast, number 199. And it is quite crazy to me that we're almost at 200. But this episode is with Lawrence Krauss, a theoretical physicist who has taught at Yale, Arizona State University, and Case Western, and is the founder of ASU's Origins Project. He's a best-selling author, and if you're an avid podcast listener, you're probably already aware that he hosts the Origins podcast as well. We have a pretty wide-ranging discussion about the current state of physics, whether or not it's in a crisis, the potential shortcomings of string theory, whether the world is a hologram, the existence of God, the role of science in ethics, and then some of his late and amazing great friends like Cormac McCarthy and Christopher Hitchens. And Lawrence's most recent book is The Edge of Knowledge, a link to which you will find in the description. One correction that I need to make is, at one point in the conversation, I say that there is a duality in M theory, where the string length in one theory is inversely proportional to the string length in another theory. And this isn't technically incorrect, but to be more precise, there's a duality in M theory, among many others, like S duality and the ADS-CFT correspondence, which I've spoken about with Juan Maldacena. But this one is called T-duality, in which the radius of the microscopic curled-up dimensions in one string theory is inversely proportional to that of another. So the connection between the two theories is more explicitly about the size of these microscopic dimensions rather than the string lengths, which opens up very interesting philosophical questions about the relativity of space-time between theories, and then also, I mean, more excitingly, whether or not space-time is physically fundamental, though that is a topic for another time. I just wanted to clarify what I was saying. But now, reviews, comments, likes, subscriptions, these things are all extraordinarily important. If you have not rated the show on Apple or Spotify, it only takes 10 seconds, 8 seconds, 7 seconds or so to do that, and that would be wonderful. There's also a Patreon if you would like a link to an ad-free RSS feed and then show notes. But now, without any further ado, I hope that you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it with Lawrence. So I recently spoke with your friend, fellow podcaster, Brian Keating, who within the field of physics kind of occupies something like the flip coin of your position as a theoretical cosmologist. And he described his attraction to being an experimentalist as kind of oriented around this idea of being an exterminator of faulty theories. And I just thought I would start by asking about what it was that attracted you to being the guy that generates these theories.
Well, it seems sexier. Let me be clear. I have great respect for experimentalists, and that respect has only grown the older I've gotten. But, you know, when you're young, you read about Newton and Galileo and Einstein. Now, it turns out Newton did experiments and so did Galileo, but you think of the, and Maxwell, and although Faraday is a big hero of mine. But, you know, so you think of the people who are sort of trying to understand nature at its very basic scale, and it's often theory. But it's also that I think there's a combination of things. So I liked mathematics, and I did a degree in mathematics as well as physics, the 2 degrees, and that, I think, played a role. When you're younger, the experiments you do in physics labs are never interesting, and I grew to hate them. But in fact, one of the reasons I did a double major, 2 degrees, was to avoid a physics lab. But also I worked for 2 or 3 years. During much of the time I was an undergraduate, I worked in a lab, a summer job. And I remember working for 5 months to fix it's like a cloud chamber. It's something to look at elementary particles in an accelerator and designing something and making the electrodes just right. And eventually got to work, but after 4 or 5 months, and I just thought, wow, do I really want to spend 5 months tuning this little thing? But of course, you know, that's what's necessary to discover the new laws of nature. And as I say, later on, I kind of began to appreciate it a lot more, and I've been a part of several experimental collaborations. But I think theory just was pure, and I think it was just a matter of thinking of who the famous physicists were that were my kind of idols, like Feynman, you know, people like, you know, and Einstein and Dirac, and it, you know, coming up with new ideas that describe nature just seemed remarkable, and also awe-inspiring in the sense that having been in that position, I don't want to make it seem like physics is done by people alone in a dark room at night, because it isn't, although people get that sense from Einstein. It's a cooperative activity. But the idea of, if you're sitting at your desk and you're at the thought that somehow nature might actually adopt what you're talking about, it's almost terrifying. It's really kind of interesting. It's a mm-hmm. weird feeling. The one or two times in my life where I've thought, and one or two times I've been right there, when I thought I really understood something about nature that was unusual and hadn't been understood before. It's a weird feeling.
I'm definitely inclined to agree with you that the theory feels much sexier. And I was surprised when I was reading his book about losing the Nobel Prize that so many more or far more Nobel Prizes go, it seems, to experimentalists than to theoretical.
That's as it should be. Look, I say that as someone who proposed something that was validated and an experimentalist, of course, won the Nobel Prize. But because science is an experimental discipline, it's an empirical discipline. It's not like math. It is the heart and soul of science is experiment. That's what determines what's true or not. Not theorists, not an elegant theory or a beautiful equation. It's whether nature adopts something. So it's perfectly appropriate that most of the Nobel Prizes they're arbitrary anyway, but most of the Nobel Prizes go to experimentalists because that's the, you know, and when we proposed dark energy as a explaining the way the universe looked while it was true, I think it's fair to say very few people believed us until the experiments validated it. The experiments convinced the world. So, it would be nice to get the Nobel Prize for that, but it's much, actually, I adopt the terminology of Feynman, which I think I really mean, and I think he really meant. For me, the great thrill was being right, was actually knowing, you know, anticipating, and that's better than I mean, anyway, the prizes are nice, but it's a real. You don't often in your career get that opportunity to have to really recognize something and understand nature in a way that hasn't been understood before.
Uh-huh. Well, something you said that you said just now that really jumped out at me is that physics isn't about equations or theory so much as it's about experiment. And this brings me to your book, Hiding in the Mirror. And
this is
the last name I'm going to drop, but this conversation is going to air right after one with Stephen Wolfram, in which we spoke all about his search for a fundamental theory of physics. So since on the Origins podcast, you've had so many conversations with physicists on adjacent topics, I thought I ought to start broadly with whether or not you think there's a crisis in physics right now. And I suspect that string theory might come into this somewhere.
I don't think there's a crisis in physics. There are different areas of physics that are having hard times, but physics itself is quite vibrant. There's new technologies being developed, properties of materials, biophysics, quantum systems. There's tremendous developments taking place, and they're exciting, a lot of them. Particle physics is in the doldrums, I would say, and has been, I mean, for lack of, coming back to what I said before, for lack of experimental evidence of things, the Standard Model, which is a book I wrote after the one you're talking about, but the book I wrote called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, is about the greatest story ever told so far. I think the greatest intellectual achievement of humankind is the Standard Model of particle physics, which explains three of the four forces of nature perfectly. And it came about in a sort of 10 to 15 year period. And it's remarkable. But since that Standard Model, there are lots of loose hole ends. There's been no evidence that's really pointed us in the direction that we should be going. We built accelerators. The discovery of the Higgs was profoundly important. I didn't believe the Higgs was actually there. I thought there'd be some nature would find some nicer mechanism to do what it did, but it didn't. I was wrong. But other than these particles having neutrinos having mass, there's really been no experimental data of any significance that's affected our understanding of the fundamental structure of matter and the forces of nature. String theory has gone on and done lots of mathematics, and it's been very helpful in various areas of physics using that mathematics, but it certainly the central premise of string theory has no evidence, there's no evidence to support it. Hiding in the mirror, I talked about why one might be led to string theory and why it's well motivated, but it hasn't really had a great success in what it originally intended to do, not a single one. It's just become more and more complicated. That doesn't mean it's wrong, but there's no evidence of it. And so particle physics per se is having a trouble. And I think that's one of the reasons many people have moved to the area that I was one of the people who sort of started in the early 1980s, the area of particle astrophysics. Because I realized at the time, even in the early 1980s, that nature, the universe, of course, was a particle physics experiment. It was performed, and now it was data analysis, and that one could look at to the universe for evidence of things that you couldn't possibly test at accelerators. So, if you want to, you could use the universe as a laboratory to test fundamental physics. And I started doing that in the early 80s, and now it's an industry because, look at the big dark energy, dark matter. These things are coming out of astrophysics and cosmology and not so much out of particle accelerators. There's still intriguing things that are happening, the anomalous magnetic moment, the muon. There's things where there are anomalies that may or may not point at some new physics. But it's been 40 years, and there really hasn't been anything significant. And I think that's hard times. The Large Hadron Collider has increased its luminosity and energy, and maybe it'll discover the particles that make up dark matter and supersymmetry, but there's been no evidence of it. And we all thought that if those things were around, supersymmetry, that would probably be the first thing that Large Hadron Collider would see and not the Higgs. And so anyway, that's an area of physics that is problematic and has been and has sort of been mired in too much theory and not enough experiment. And whenever that happens, I think theories, physics has problems. But it's only one area of physics, and physics encompasses so many things. So I don't think physics is a crisis at all.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm very glad that you disambiguated physics in general and pointed out that there are so many different subfields. But maybe before we come back to particle physics, which is, as you say, is in the doldrums, I'd like to, I guess, clarify something that's closer to home for you. So are you saying that cosmology is, or particle astrophysics is just sort of humming along in this normal science period within a paradigm, or it's not like in need of a revolution or anything right now?
Well, it sounds a little too philosophical for me, that whole question. Look, there's new, anytime you open a new window on the universe, you're surprised and it's exciting. And there are lots of new windows in the universe opening up with James Webb Space Telescope and new other and planet finding missions too. But and, you know, and dark energy, I don't think there's anything interesting that's happened with dark energy since we first proposed it and it was first observed, which I said at the time. I said, it's not going to be everything I could think about it theoretically would suggest that there wouldn't be any evidence that would tell you exactly what it was. And that's been valid. I even made a bet with Stephen Hawking and a Nobel Prize winning friend of mine, Frank Wilczek, although Frank has refused to acknowledge that we made the bet, where, you know, they both said we'd understand dark energy in 10 years. And I said, we won't. Anyway, that was years ago. But so I think there's lots of exciting observations going on with new machines and new telescopes and new satellites. And so, yeah, it's spinning along. Not as if, I mean, as I say, the standard model of cosmology, in some sense, I'm worried, I even have written about this, might become like the standard model of particle physics, because while there are always little nuggets that suggest there may be some tweak here or there, usually they're found to be wrong. A recent example is they claimed to see galaxies far too early, and then it was discovered they weren't as early as people thought. And so the standard model of cosmology, with this weird dark energy, which we don't understand, and weird dark matter, which we have a better idea of thinking about possibilities for it, but we have no evidence for it directly, has withstood the test of time. And it's this model where we don't understand the basics, but appears to describe the universe. And I am worried that if future observations just continue to validate this picture without any evidence that points us in a new direction of fundamental understanding, that it could become problematic too.
Do you have any hunches at the moment about dark energy or dark matter?
Sure.
Any in particular that you give really high credence to?
Look, a hunch is a hunch. As a scientist, I know that that's what all it is. It's a speculation. Look, particle dark matter, the likelihood that dark matter is a new type of elementary particle is overwhelming, I think. And you know, the standard candidates are very good candidates. Supersymmetry and particles called axions are the best, the only real kosher candidates that I would say, because they were developed to explain problems in particle physics having nothing to do with dark matter. I mean, you know, young people or other people like to invent dark matter particles to kind of fit the data, but that's garbage, because they're not motivated from a fundamental perspective. But both supersymmetry and axions, which address the strong CP problem, a fundamental problem of symmetries in particle theory, were all proposed having nothing to do with dark matter. And then it was discovered they could be perfect candidates. So I have to say those are my two, still maintain my, they're still my favorite candidates. Supersymmetry has gone down in my hunch in the betting pool because of Large Hadron Collider. And I regularly think of new experiments. I thought, look, the experiments that are being used to look for dark matter are experiments that I proposed 40 years ago in part. And I've thought a lot of ways about trying to detect axions. It's fascinating for me. So I continue to think about those things. It's great to propose the experiments, because then the experiment just spent 40 years building them, but you can just write the paper and you can go on and do something else. But dark energy, I have no, look, I have no idea. I mean, anyone who tells you they have an idea about dark energy is lying. I mean, they have an idea, but it's not worth talking about. We really have no fundamental. It's the most bizarre thing in physics. There's no. It's inexplicable in a fundamental way. Now, I proposed models for it and why you might understand why it's so small. But I'd be amazed if any of them were right.
Before we move on, though, I'd like to get back to that dark matter very briefly. But how was it that you proposed testing axions? Granted that,
the dark matter, the WIMP detectors are one that had more involved in the early stages, where we proposed detectors that could detect very small energy deposits and big detectors underground, and those are being built. When it comes to axions, that fundamental idea of using axions change electromagnetism a little bit. And the original idea of converting cosmic axions into electromagnetic signals was really due to a guy named Pierre Sakivi. We looked at ways to make it practical with my friend Frank Wilczek, who had proposed the name axions, by the way, when he first proposed axions. And so I've thought about ways to actually implement this idea that axions affect electromagnetism in a variety of ways. We did the first realistic calculations of what the rates of detector production of axion induced signals would be for experimentalists who then built experiments based on that. And those experiments keep getting refined. And I've proposed different kinds of experiments. Now I've been looking at lasers and I wrote a paper a few years ago on that, and it may or may not become useful. So I keep trying. It's a joy for me over the last 40 years to periodically learn enough about experiments to be able to propose, or learn enough about technology to be able to propose new possible experiments. And so we'll see.
Well, okay, two things. One, I just wanted to flag that at the outset of that first question I asked about particle astrophysics, you said that the question sounded a bit too philosophical for you. And yeah, it in the landscape of physicists and public intellectual scientists, I think of you and Neil deGrasse Tyson as the two big figures who are somewhat anti-philosophy, or at least that's anti some modern philosophy.
I get a rap of being anti-philosophy, and I'm not, but it's useful in certain places and isn't useful in others.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to get back to that, flag it and get back to it maybe a little bit later, but returning for the moment to string theory and quantum gravity, and it seemed like the big problem for you with string theory was that it hasn't had any experimental success. So,
string theory, it's not a problem for me.
Right, for string theory.
Yeah.
But so in general, where do you weigh in on the state of quantum gravity research? Since I'm guessing that this is one of the areas, even though I don't think we've used that term yet, where you think there really is a crisis.
Well, no, look, the problem is quantum gravity is the region where quantum mechanical effects impact on gravity is a region that's so far removed from anything you could directly test in the laboratory. Gravity is the weakest force in nature in the first place. It's hard to measure classical gravity at a fundamental scale. Quantum gravity effects are on unbelievably small scales. The only places they're relevant, and I mean it, probably, the only places they're relevant are the final stages of collapse of a black hole and the very beginning of the universe. Other than that, quantum gravity probably is irrelevant. General relativity works fine. But I actually have worked on quantum gravity recently. I wrote a paper in Nature recently, Nature Physics Reviews, with some colleagues from Europe, thinking about ways you might test quantum gravity by looking for analogs in condensed matter systems. You know, black holes have a horizon because the escape velocity is faster than the speed of light. Well, you can create, and that results in something called Hawking radiation, Hawking first realized when you consider quantum effects. And looking at certain classical fluids, or not necessarily classical, semi-classical fluids or even quantum fluids, in condensed matter systems, people have created analogs of black holes where you can measure Hawking-like radiation. And so I wrote a paper thinking about whether you might be able to probe other features of quantum gravity by appropriate condensed matter systems. So you might analogs. And of course, they're always analogs. So you'll be able to just get ideas of what effects may or may not be important. It's not quantum gravity directly, but it might be useful for trying to understand how to probe it. So I have thought about that a little bit. But on the whole, it's kind of a sterile enterprise, because that's why string theories have such problems, because the areas where you're going to correct classical general relativity are areas that are so far removed from anything generally we could directly detect that it makes it extremely difficult to imagine how the theory would be validated, or how you'd even do the right theory.
So your idea would be that rather than to generate a theory first, like string theory, and then perform experiments based on it, which we don't have the energy to do, it would be to go into something like a condensed matter system and try to find first data, and then...
Well, it may not be either or. That's the point. It's just you look 1,000 points of light. You look everywhere you can. So string theory, you know, directly, and there may be experiments you can do, but this is another approach. So it's not either or, I think. It's just you're flailing around and you look at anything you can find. You look under where the lamppost is. I've used that analogy many times, right? If you're drunk and you come out of a bar and you've lost your keys, where do you look? You look under a lamppost. Well, not because they're there necessarily, but because of the only place you'll find them if they're there. Anyway.
So granted, though, that the quantum gravity effects are extremely small and there haven't been experiments to test the various theories, does that mean that you're pretty much agnostic on all of them, agnostic on string theory, loop quantum gravity, causal set theory, all of these things? Or do you have any horse in the race?
I'm generally an agnostic about everything, but I do.
You're an anti-theist. I used to be.
Now that's because my friend Christopher Hitchens used to say that, and I like the idea. But I'm much more of an apatheist. I really don't give a damn. I mean, God is irrelevant to me, so I don't even think about the question. So an apatheist is my theism. When it comes to different theories, there are ones that I find more potentially more likely, or at least more well motivated, and I happen to think string theory is more well motivated than loop quantum gravity. So, but that, you know, and I think it's also had a bigger impact on the rest of physics than loop quantum gravity has, because it's developed new kinds of mathematics. That doesn't mean loop quantum gravity won't someday be useful. And I talked to Carlo Rovelli, and who is convinced that it is. I'm not, but So I had preferences, I'd bet on string theory over loop quantum gravity, but I wouldn't bet a lot of money on either of them. And the famous story of it was about another speculation in physics, and it had to do with my late friend and mentor and colleague Steven Weinberg, won the Nobel Prize, and it's a remarkable physicist. And I think it was about inflation, and I think it was someone said, would you bet your life, or would you bet your oldest child on inflation being true? And Alan Guth said one thing, he would bet this, but he wouldn't bet his old child. Andre Linde said he'd bet his oldest child. And Stephen Weinberger said, I would bet Andre Linde's oldest child. Which I thought was a good anyway. So I wouldn't, I think the point that people don't realize is most theories are wrong. Most theories are wrong. If they weren't, anyone could do it. I mean, I've written hundreds of scientific papers, and some of them are really beautiful theories, but nature chose not to adopt them. And, you just keep plugging away. And if every paper you came up with was right, it would just be almost boring.
Okay, you've mentioned another couple of things that to flag and come back to. One is Christopher Hitchens, who I'm very curious to hear about. And then another is inflation, Andre Linde and Alan Guth. But for the moment, I actually like to stick to the string theory and ask a couple of philosophical questions. And so one of them, before we talked, I jotted down just some potential pro-string theory arguments, some of which are philosophical, because I've had a number of conversations on the show with people like Juan Maldacena and Andy Strominger and Eric Berlinda about it. So it's just on my mind.
Let me interject that I think my book, Hiding in the Mirror, is very optimistic. I mean, it really explains why string theory is motivated. But anyway, go on. Mm-hmm.
One problem that I don't know, it's just an intuitive prejudice with quantum mechanics is that it has point particles. And I like the idea of string theory replacing them with little strings. Do you find point particles at all disturbing to admit into the furniture of the universe?
No, because they're not really, but I mean, because they're not really. Yes and no. Look, I mean, when you get to infinitesimal things, obviously something is going to cut that off. Things aren't infinitesimally small. They're not infinitely small. There's going to be some effects that are going to cut off that singularity. I don't think, I think as string theorists have learned, strings are not the fundamental objects in string theory anymore. It's brains. And so I don't even know what the fundamental objects are, but I don't find little strings any less or any more physically plausible than fundamental point particles. Because really what string theory does, it's a lot of fancy mathematics and to be fair, much of which I don't even comprehend. But the fundamental idea, the reason it works is it just gives you a cutoff. Instead of going, I mean, infinitely small, string theory has this thing called duality. So there's a smaller size, there's a duality. So when you go to smaller scales, it's equivalent to something at larger scales. So it's just like saying, well, I there is a smaller size below which things don't exist. And if I said that, I could say that for point particles, and they'd be just as finite. The conclusions that came about would be just as finite as they are in string theory.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify something you said about strings not being the sort of fundamental particles in string theory or M theory, is it the case that they're not fundamental or just that there are multiple fundamental things?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, there are multiple fundamentals. One, the reason it's called M theory is you don't even know what the theory is a theory of. Mm-hmm. And my former colleague and friend Joe Polchinski, before he died, was one of the people who first recognized that brains, that something called brains are probably fundamental to understanding the mathematics of string theory. And these brain-like objects are, I think, what now are of greatest interest. But what are the ultimate variables of the theory and what it describes? Some people may correct me here, but I think at this point no one knows. It's a crapshoot, and it's full of fascinating ideas and objects and mathematics, and the practitioners are fascinated by it, and also they're true believers, which sort of have to be if you're working for 30 years. The good thing is those of them who are scientists, and not all of them are. And by that, I mean not scientists in the true spirit of science. Those of them that are scientists would be willing to drop it, like yesterday's newspaper, if it actually made a prediction that was wrong. So they're science, but most of them who are doing it are scientists in that true sense. They're true believers. They work on it. They're convinced it's right. But happily, if it were proved to be wrong, they'd throw it out. So I give them the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm not a string theorist, so I will also probably be open to correction here, but my understanding is that in M theory, there is this web of dualities where there's a smallest length and of one string in one theory, and it can be sort of translated into a larger string in another string theory.
Yeah, there's a scale below which you can't go because everything smaller than it is equivalent to larger. So effectively, it means like the physics has a small scale. The string associated with the string tension.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say is that this leads to space not really being continuous. There is this smallest scale, and you said that's kind of why it works for quantizing gravity in some respects. But that's not the case for quantum field theory, where space is continuous, and that's why we have these point particles. And I'm wondering if the continuity of space, as opposed to this discreteness of being space, is problematic for you at all.
Well, it is. But quantum field theory isn't a theory of gravity. It's not a theory of space. It's a theory of fields within space. But if you put a cutoff, if you say there's a smaller scale, then quantum field theory works very well and doesn't produce infinities. But that's that you have to impose that.
Right, it's arbitrary.
Outside. But, you know, that's the problem. Quantum field theory, but it's okay. We understand the world in terms of effective theories now. There is no fundamental theory. Some string theorists may think they have it, but up to that point, there's no fundamental theory that's true. None of the theories we have now are absolutely true. They're all effective theories. And we all expect that at some high scale of energy and small scale of distance, that those theories will be modified. The problems with quantum field theory, and there are no problems, but where it looks like there are problems, the infinities, arise from extrapolating the theory to a domain where you know it's not true. But the great thing is the theories that make sense have results that are independent of the nonsense that scale where you know things are wrong. That's called renormalizability. You can effectively get rid of those infinities in a way that they don't affect any of the predictions of the theory at low energy scales. And it was a mystery to Feynman, who used it who developed a way to understand renormalizability and get a sensible theory of quantum electrodynamics. And he thought it was like some magic box. I assume at the end of his life he knew. I talked to him near them, but certainly of course he knew. But when he got the Nobel Prize, he talked about this is just some magic prescription that has no, we don't understand it, but we do understand it now. We understand it was Ken Wilson and others who helped us understand what we now call effective theories, and that the whole world is an effective theory. There's none of the theories we have are fundamental. That doesn't bother us.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last sort of philosophical question in this area that I'll ask you is, I mean, in our macroscopic picture of the world, we see it as kind of populated by objects, definite objects. We don't have this idea of invisible forces, invisible fields. And my understanding is that in quantum field theory, the fields are sort of the fundamental objects, and what we measure as particles are just perturbations in the field.
Excitations of the fields, yeah. The fields are fundamental. They're quantum fields. And what that tells you is a field gives you the probability of creating a particle in a given place. And that's the fundamental the fundamental variable is the probability of creating or destroying particles here or there. And that's what quantum fields are.
Mm-hmm. But what I was going to contrast this with string or M theory, where vibrations of brains or strings, kind of those are what's fundamental, and then the fields are just emergent. They're effective descriptions.
Well, I don't know whether they're any more emergent. They're particles are excitations of quantum fields, fundamental quantum excitations of quantum fields. String theory, the strings are quantized, and their modes are quantized, and particles are excitations are quantized modes of a string. I don't really see anything fundamentally different from that, a quantized mode of a field. But I mean, in spirit, it's exactly the same thing to me, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe a limitation of my thinking, but I don't really see any real difference. The real difference is that it's an excitation of an object.
Right.
But it's a mathematical object. The strings may not even exist. They may be, we often create mathematical crutches, and many times people thought, Faraday thought his fields, and he invented the idea of fields, even though he's an experimentalist, and he thought they were a crutch that allowed him to, because he couldn't do the mathematics, the algebra, without it. And then, Gell-Mann invented quarks, but he also thought they were hypothetical, just mathematical tools that helped you understand some basic premise of of strongly attracting particles, but they turned out to be real. And strings, if that theory does apply to nature, may be real, or they could just be mathematical constructs that help you understand the mathematics of what's going on. Anyway, but the bottom line is, you're right. There's one. Strings are objects, and when they're excited, they create different particles. Fields are not objects per se. They're mathematical constructs, but we also think they correspond to things in reality. I guess it's semantics, and I don't like to get embroiled in semantics if I can help it. One of the problems of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two last things in Hiding in the Mirror that I wanted to talk about. So Hiding in the Mirror is not about string theory per se. It's about multiple dimensions.
It's about the fascinations that humans have had with the idea that there's more out there than meets the eye in a true sense, that there are extra dimensions. And the reason I wrote the book was to just teach myself something. And I wanted to learn about the history of that idea in art and literature. And and so I followed it back to the 19th century, and it was fun to learn about its impact in literature and art and the art movements of the early 20th century.
Yeah. Speaking of literature, this is unrelated, but I know that you interviewed Cormac McCarthy, which is just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I know. Cormac was a friend, he never did interviews. He trusted me a little bit, but near the end, he was never talking to me. He was always like getting blood from a stone, and I knew it would be, but at least he agreed. And I wanted to do it while he was still alive, and he agreed. And that was a great show of trust.
Yeah, no,
he was very tired amazing. That day and really didn't want to talk much. I know people think I talk too much, but you don't understand what it was like to be on the couch with Cormac when he was tired and all, but it was a great gift, and it was a great gift to know him. And it was a great gift to have him edit one of my books.
Oh, really? And, wow.
Yeah, he edited. Yeah, yeah. He actually edited two, but he officially edited my book Quantum Man, which is a scientific biography of Richard Feynman. And he liked the hardcover so much that he wrote me and said, "I can make the paperback perfect if you let me edit it." I said, "Of course." And he said, "One rule, though, or two rules, you got to get rid of all exclamation marks and all semicolons. There's
really?
No Roman English literature for either." So I said, "Fine." And he edited it. And then if you look at the paperback of Quantum Man, you'll see it says with edited by Cormac McCarthy.
Huh. So I can understand the semicolons, but I knew that he's very kind of anti-excessive punctuation. But do you have any insight into why he didn't like the exclamation points?
No. I don't think I ever asked him. I just said, "Whatever you want to do, Cormac, is fine with me."
Yeah, that's funny. I he's on my mind because I was just talking about Blood Meridian this morning.
Yeah, no, actually. I mean, it's I'm very lucky to have known a lot of interesting people and had them as friends. And I'm always kind of surprised when they want to be my friends. But Cormac was we go back and he agreed to do things that I don't think he would have done otherwise we hadn't been so kind and generous as a friend. And he changed my thinking about the world in numerous ways. I've already talked about it many times that when I first met him, he was very chipper. He was in a lunchroom of an institute in Santa Fe. And I kind of couldn't connect that kind of jovial, happy fellow with the guy who wrote No Country for Old Men and The Road. And I said, "How can you be so chipper, you know?" And he said, "Well, I'm a pessimist, but that's no reason to be gloomy." And that's become my mantra in life, I think so.
No, that's good. I've read The Road, which is wonderful, but I haven't
difficult to read
No Country for Old Men, but it's a terrific movie.
Well, the book is better than the movie. I read the book before I saw the movie, and the movie is pretty good. It's a pretty faithful rendition, but as always, the book is generally better. Mm-hmm. And it certainly doesn't present a hopeful view of humanity.
Yeah. But speaking of these, I mean, wonderful friends, you've mentioned a number of phenomenal physicists already, and then there's Christopher Hitchens, and I saw that, and speaking of them helping you with your writing in various ways, I saw that Christopher Hitchens was going to write, was it an afterword for Universe from Nothing, but then...
No, he was writing the foreword. Richard Dawkins wrote the afterword, and he, yeah, and Christopher had finished half of it, and he told me about it, and it was great, and I was very sorry that it couldn't be used.
I occasionally think about how terrific he would have been as a podcast guest or as a podcaster himself.
He would have been. Yeah, no one could compete with him. He would have been, he was a terrific speaker. And yeah, and now you've made me wistful, because it would have been amazing to have the foreword from Christopher and the afterword from Richard. And this foreword is really good. I tried to indicate later on in my lectures, I've talked about some of the ideas that he presented in his foreword. And I've used them in my lectures, and of course, given him credit. Hmm. Anyway, it was fun to talk to him about science, and he was wonderful.
Well, the last thing I'll say on this note before we get back to our main thread is I also saw that you've interviewed Douglas Murray, and when I think of Christopher Hitchens, Douglas Murray now comes to mind. I recently saw a debate that he did with Malcolm Gladwell, and I have just never seen somebody perform so like powerfully in a debate before, that it was whispers of Hitchens.
Yeah. Douglas, I've said it. I think I said it in that podcast, or at least my introduction to the podcast. He reminds me a lot of Christopher. Hmm. Some people hate him because but I think he's very similar in his love of literature, his willingness to explore as a journalist, war zones, but he can be devastating in debate. I haven't watched him debate Malcolm Gladwell. I assume he eviscerated him.
It was it was so horrendous that Malcolm Gladwell went to like a debate school and did a whole episode on his own podcast about how terribly he did in the debate.
Well, good. Good. I mean, you know, Gladwell's a charming speaker, but yeah, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be on the other side. I wouldn't want to be on the other side of a debate against Douglas Murray. Happily, I wasn't, although, you know, we disagree fundamentally about a number of things. I don't think we talked about climate change, for example, where he's definitely wrong. But
he's anti-climate change.
I think he's more skeptical than he should be, or less understanding of the fundamental things that are accurate about climate science.
Right. We've both spoken with Tim Palmer, who I think makes a very persuasive case about.
Oh yeah, these things. Yeah. He's written a good book, and that's why he wrote Talk to Him, I guess. And I don't know his view, but well, you know, I don't want to put words in Douglas's. It wouldn't surprise me if he was also. He's not anti-vax because he's not ridiculous, but we probably have different views about the need for vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. You know, I know. Anyway,
no. But I
don't agree with anything. But then I didn't agree with Christopher on the invasion of Iraq. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, now this is really the last thing I'll say. I very much appreciate
that. But then it goes on.
Yeah. That on your show, you interview people that you don't agree with on everything, mm-hmm. and you treat them well, because that's not really the case on every podcast.
Yeah. No. A lot of them are echo chambers. I learned that from Christopher. Christopher was the most generous person I knew in terms of, you know, people think he's a bulldog, but he was the most generous person I knew, being able to talk to and enjoy people with whom he was diametrically opposed on ideology or philosophy. And it's a wonderful thing. So I think I tried to emulate that in some sense, because I don't think, yeah, it's important. That's the whole point, is that talk to people you disagree with. Otherwise, that's the whole point of free speech, mm-hmm. and the whole point of conversations. So yeah, I do talk to a lot of people I agree with, but I really like it when I have a conversation with someone. And of course, I get just the most vitriolic hate when Douglas was on. I mean, if you read the comments from some people, it's just amazing how much they hate that guy. And you know, And it works in the other direction as well. So,
yeah. I did a few episodes recently on Israel and Palestine, talking to people from different perspectives. So if I have a left-leaning person, some people hate him, some people love him. If I have a right-leaning person, it's the same thing.
Yeah. So you just got to, hopefully, you know, it's nice to have something where the point is that the noisemakers are always in the minority, that most people want to actually hear different perspectives. And then more importantly, those are the people you're really appealing to. The other people, you're never going to change their minds or even have them listen. But the vast majority of people are people who are willing to hear something new and think about it. I like to think, otherwise I don't know why I do many of the things I do.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Now returning to those last two points I wanted to ask about regarding hiding in the mirror, but this isn't quite cosmology, or maybe it is depending on the attitude you take, and it is certainly not about more dimensions, it's about mm-hmm. less dimensions. But with Juan Maldacena in particular, we talked about the ADS-CFT yes. correspondence, so anti-de Sitter space conformal.
And Drake, that's what his key insight was as a graduate student.
Theory.
Famous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the holographic principle, and the holographic principle on which ADS-CFT is based didn't arise out of string theory. Gerard and Hooft first formulated it, and it had to do with black holes, black hole entropy and Hawking radiation. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether or not you put any credence in it as a model of the universe in which there is sort of a two-dimensional boundary or three-dimensional, depending on how you look at it, in which our universe is just sort of a, as we know it, the bulk is just a projection of that.
Well, I think...
The interesting thing about it is that
this whole holographic principle and ASCFT suggests that the notion of dimensions might be illusory, that it's really not... Well, it's like waves and particles. I mean, it's a nice description, but it may not have an absolute reality in the sense that what you mean by dimension, one observer could think they live in a universe that has a different number of dimensions than the other observer does, because you can completely thinks it is true. You can completely describe nature in a different set of variables. Whether it's just a mathematical trick or whether it has a more profound physical reality is something, again, I don't know. But if the mathematics were really true, and let's face it, it's not true in any system that we know of that we're living. I mean, it's true in extreme idealizations. But if it were true, then it really would mean that from a point of view of a physicist, the dimension is not an absolute quantity any more than time or space is. One person's time is another person's space in relativity. One person's time interval is another person's space interval.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're just, for you, the jury's out, and at least at the moment, it's an interesting mathematical device.
Oh, it's fascinating mathematics. I think it's one of the more interesting things that's come out of string theory, at least in terms of, and of course, it just is the father of many great ideas in physics. It's a fascinating idea. It's a lot of useful work because sometimes thinking of a physical system one way, it makes it very hard to calculate. If you think of it the other way, it makes it very easy, well, easier to calculate. And it's been very, very useful tool in that sense, taking systems that for which you can't calculate predictions, but mapping them into their dual partners, it allows you to use well-known techniques to do calculations. So it's been very useful in a variety of areas of physics.
Hmm. This is, it goes back to something you said earlier, but it reminds me of Andy Strominger's position, where he's just totally agnostic, or maybe he's an apatheist, but about whether or not strings exist. He doesn't think we will ever discover them, and he views his work in a purely sort of instrumental way. He thinks that all of these are just great tools for solving problems, like with the black hole entropy problem that he solved.
That's interesting that Andy thinks that. It's a reasonable approach. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been interested in quantum gravity since he was a student. Since I was a student, we were both students together. I know him well, so.
Mm-hmm. But I guess this is a place where I see room for philosophers of physics, because Eric Verlinde, for instance, he doesn't believe, this came out of our conversation, that singularities exist at the center of black holes. He said he doesn't think about it at all. All that's real to him is the surface, because that's where all the information is contained.
Well, fine. Who the hell cares? No offense to Eric, but who the hell cares what he thinks? Nature is the way it is. And we shouldn't use the word believe. And it's true that we can't access any, that it's a mystery, and it's useless to talk about singularities because we don't have the physics to understand that. And so you work with the system that you can understand. And it's fine for him to say that all that matters is the surface. That may provide all the information you need about the formation and evolution of black holes. But things really presumably do fall inside black holes, and it might be of interest to find out what happens to them.
Yes, unless they don't fall into black holes and something's just happening on the surface.
Well, yeah, maybe Eric believes that. I think that would be hard to.
Well, I mean, if you take
we came up with an argument. I have a paper with a colleague of mine, Tom Mavetsaspati, and a few others years ago, which still gets some interest. The question whether black holes even exist. It could be that basically things that appear from the outside like black holes form, but you never actually get to an event horizon or a singularity, that the system evaporates quantum mechanically before any of those surfaces or singularities form.
Could you
showed it with a calculation? If that's true, then there is no paradox, and when from the outside it looks like a system, it looks like a black hole, but it's not really a black hole. And that to me is a very satisfactory solution. I don't know if it's right. I bet it isn't, but it's still interesting.
Could you walk me through how this account would look when a star collapses? Like what would be happening?
Well, when a star collapses, you know, stuff is collapsing, right?
Yeah.
And it's getting denser and denser and denser. But quantum mechanical effects are relevant as it gets denser and denser and denser. And the system can, their excitation, it can radiate away energy. And the question is, does it radiate away its energy before the system collapses to be within its own event horizon or not? And if it does, if it keeps radiating energy at a sufficiently high rate, then the event horizon never catches up to the surface that's collapsing, and the whole system evaporates before any event horizon has been formed. It sounds like a scam, but it can work.
So what would account for the fact that we don't observe radiation coming out of black holes?
Well, it's because these effects happen because time scales associated with them. You know, if you're talking about effects as seen from an observer at infinity, very short time scales on the scale of a black hole event horizon translate into very long times for an outside observer. So just like, you know, in a regular black hole, you don't see something fall in, you see it slow down and freeze at the surface. And so the question is what you're seeing is a very dense thing which may not even exist anymore.
I see. Okay, that's very cool. I hadn't heard that.
And the point is, it may be cool, but there were calculations that support that picture using collapse of spherical shells. I doubt it's right, but it is kind of cool. Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, well, last thing.
There's one way to resolve a paradox that I still don't think has been resolved about black hole and black holes and inspiration. Anyway.
Well, the last thing about hitting in the mirror and extra dimensions, just restricting us to the extra dimensions for the moment. Are you at this point all in on a four-dimensional space-time, or are your fingers crossed for 26-dimensional universe? Or
I'm not all in on anything that I haven't been able to measure or test. So I see no evidence for extra dimensions beyond four at this point. And I tend to side with Feynman, who said that they don't, string theory doesn't explain anything. It just makes excuses. But the big thing that string theory never does is explain why, if there are many dimensions, why we live in a universe that appears to be four dimensional. Well, it sort of does. It does by the anthropic argument that many different, you know, universes of different dimensionality could exist, and maybe we live in one that's four dimensional because it, you know, we can, and that argument works, but it doesn't explain anything. It makes excuses. It's plausible, perhaps. So yeah, I'm suspicious of extra dimensions. Yeah, I guess I'm skeptical, but you know they. But I wouldn't be shocked if they exist. But if you asked me to bet, I'd bet against them.
Hmm. Okay, well, I guess maybe closing the chapter on extra dimensions. Returning to something you said earlier.
I love extra. I wrote a book about it because I'm fascinated. I mean, I think it's fascinating. Particularly large extra dimensions, and I'm very happy. I don't know if I put it in the book. I probably did. You know, I've had students mine who played a key role in making extra dimensions much more fashionable, making extra dimensions large. You know, in string theory, the original idea was the extra dimensions were curled up on scales so small you can never measure them. But it was realized by a bunch of people, including one of my graduate students, Raman Sundaram, along with Lisa, at the time he was working with Lisa Randall, that it's possible they could be large. And that's fascinating, although I'm pretty sure it's wrong. Well, all the tests have shown it isn't. The original motivation for it appears to be gone. And it was extremely ugly. But as I point out, it got him tenure, and I'm very happy for that reason.
No, that's great. Especially if physics is as difficult to get tenure in as philosophy is.
Well, it depends. Yeah, well, let's not go into that. But, I mean, it's not, yeah. Mm-hmm. It depends who you are.
Mm-hmm. But, okay. Returning to Christopher Hitchens, and you said that he gave you the name anti-theist, but you have since become, you said, an apatheist?
He said, look, he doesn't accept that there's a God, but he wouldn't want to live in a universe with a God. Particularly the God of any of the Abrahamic religions. And I agree, I wouldn't want to live in such a universe. What an awful creature, what an awful being who would want to ever live in a universe controlled by such a prick. But, and that's true, but for me, much more importantly, I'm an apatheist because people somehow think that God is important in science, that the issue of God and science and creation comes up all the time. And I've been a scientist for over 40 years, and I never heard the word come up in any scientific meeting. God just doesn't matter when it comes to science. God is irrelevant. And so, why talk about God? I mean, we could talk about unicorns. They're just as relevant.
Mm-hmm. So I read God is Not Great when I was in high school, and it sparked a militant anti-theist phase for me that lasted about a year or two.
It's the best book on the subject, in my opinion.
He's terrific. But so I know that you have spent a lot of time debating theologians and talking publicly with Richard Dawkins, for instance, on the topic. But now that you're an apatheist, is that stage of your life over?
I never like to think in those terms. I stopped debating theologians a while ago because I just found it tiresome, and I think I'd said everything I needed to say. So I get requests all the time. And so I'm happy to have a conversation with someone whose views are different than mine in that regard, but not that that's the central being of their existence. I think that under the right circumstances, I don't like debate. I also just don't like debates anymore. I just prefer to have dialogues than debates. I don't like the format of a debate. I think it's not designed to inform. It's all based on performance and rhetoric. That's the word I was looking for. And so I'd rather just have a dialogue and find areas where you agree and disagree, but it, not to have, not to make a statement, to have these diametrically opposed statements that one person has to defend and the other person has to criticize. It's a form of entertainment, but it's not particularly useful.
Well, one thing that I wanted to ask about regarding theism and anti-theism relates to a conversation I had on the show with Sean Carroll and then a philosopher that I know you've
Well, Sean Carroll's a philosopher, isn't he? Okay, sorry,
Yes,
go on.
another philosopher that I know you've had some back and forth with, David Albert, but we talked about fine-tuning, and Sean said that he thought that the argument for fine-tuning is the best argument for the existence of God, but it's also just a terrible argument. And for our listeners who aren't really familiar with it,
Wow,
I'm
that's
wondering.
surprised you said that, but then, wow, that's a stupid thing to say.
Oh, why? Because you think it's a good argument for the existence of God?
Oh, I thought he said it. Did you say he said it was the best argument?
He said it
Did I
was the
just?
best argument, but it's still a bad argument.
I don't think it's a good. I don't even think it's the best argument.
Okay, well, for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, could you say how you think the argument goes and why it's not even a good argument?
The argument goes, and it's an incorrect argument, first of all. So that's the whole point. It's no argument in any case. There's no such thing as fine-tuning. The universe isn't fine-tuned. No matter it may look like it's fine-tuned, but it's not fine-tuned. But the argument is certain characteristics, like the cosmological constant, like the energy of space, that if they were any different, life like us would not have arisen. And moreover, the value of that energy is so absurdly inexplicable that it appears that it has to be fine-tuned, that any other value is more sensible than the one it has. Now, the problem with that argument is twofold, threefold, well, n-fold. That, first of all, it presumes. It presumes that there isn't a natural explanation of why the energy of empty space has the value it does. And historically, that's generally been the case when things have been used, when the anthropic argument has been used to understand something. It's really lately, ultimately been shown to be supplanted by a fundamental explanation of why things are the way they are, first. But secondly, so they're fine. If they were different, then we might be different and having a discussion about why that the different value is so special. It assumes that all life is the only life that can exist is life like you and me. And no other life forms that could exist under different, very different circumstances. And that's just such a myopic view. That I, you know, so it's based on this that presumption, and moreover, the people who usually say it don't understand that, for example, that while you can use the existence of life as an explanation for why the energy of empty space is what it is, assuming there are an infinite number of universes and universes. Are formed and they have a random value of that energy of empty space. Well, you can predict by the fact that we're here that the energy of empty space should not be larger than X. and it should be of the order of magnitude, if it's not zero, that we observe it to have it. And that was Steven Weinberg's argument. But in fact, if you actually looked at it, if the energy of empty space were precisely zero, which is what we all thought before some of us proposed it wasn't, then it'd be better for life. Life would live longer in our universe. So the universe would have more life in it than it has, if it has other forms of life. So it's not as if the value we have is the best value for life to exist. If it was zero, it would be much better. So, every argument about fine-tuning seems to me to have huge holes in it and huge assumptions, most of which are generally wrong. And I'm partly to blame in the sense that because I proposed the cosmological constant before it was observed, and I pointed out how ridiculous it was, how ridiculous the value was. And I remember saying it's unbelievably, fine-tuned in that sense that why would it have that value? It was mostly just to be provocative, but I don't think there's any fundamental philosophical argument that makes sense based on the fact that the cosmological constant has a value that no one can understand. I mean, everyone that is just specious or superficial. And I even wrote scientific papers on this. If you assume that life isn't like our forms of life, you can make a same argument for why Weinberg's argument for why the cosmological constant should have the value it roughly has falls apart. If you make other assumptions about the nature of life, you can predict the cosmological constant a vastly different number. So anyway, the fine-tuning argument, it's such a bad argument for God, because it looks like you're saying God had to fine-tune this number to one part in 120 so that his beautiful creation could exist. But my point is, God could have made it zero, which is the sensible value, and we could exist and everything could be better. So God's a pretty crummy architect if he chose this ridiculous value, mm-hmm. when zero would have made everyone happier, and we would all be living longer, and there'd be a lot more life in the universe. So the argument that ridiculous value points to an intelligent designer is ridiculous. It points to a pretty unintelligent designer, like most arguments by intelligent design.
Mm-hmm. So, this also connects to Alan Guth and Andre Lindy, who you mentioned, and inflation, and also to string theory. And one of the, I think, arguments for string theory that I didn't mention yet is it purports in some fashion to account for fine tuning, because our physics arises out of a fundamental theory, whereas the standard particle model, has these 17 or so free parameters that have to be settled by experiment. But by your expression, I can tell that
that's the biggest failure of string theory, perhaps of all the failures of string theory, and there are many, is that string theory hasn't explained the one thing that you think a quantum theory of gravity would explain, which is why the energy of empty space is what it is. It's given us no insight into that whatsoever. Generally, string theories predict a value which is vastly different than what we see. It's been the biggest failure of string theory. So to argue that somehow it accounts for fine-tuning is the exact opposite. String theory has nothing to say about it except to potentially give a playing field which allows the anthropic principle. Because string theory ostensibly has many possible vacua, we don't know for sure, but appears to have many possible ground states, potentially, huge, infinite almost, but maybe not infinite, but almost. It gives you the platform for saying, well, all sorts of different universes could exist, and the only ones that we'd be living in would look like the ones we live in. So yeah, but we don't need string theory for that. But it gives you, the multiverse of inflation is much more well motivated than the multiverse of string theory.
So just to make sure that I'm not making a mistake here, there are plenty of string theorists who do think that string theory accounts for the fine-tuning problem. This isn't just something that I'm manufacturing, right?
What you mean for the value of the energy of empty space being so small?
No, for the fact that there are like 10 to the 500 ground states of the string, and each one might correspond to a different universe in this multiverse, and would thus be ours.
Yeah, well, that's not string theory. That's the anthropic principle. That's saying that, yeah, we can't predict anything, but if anything's possible, then it's not surprising that we exist. Yeah, if that's an explanation.
But that comes out of string theory, related to string theory in this sense.
The anthropic playing field, the string landscape, gives a fundament. It does give a motivation for the anthropic principle, but it's not the only one, and I think it's not the best motivated one.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the best motivated one is the inflationary one that you were
absolutely, just... absolutely, okay. Because inflation relies on physics we understand, and it's almost inevitable. It's almost inevitable that our universe is part of an inflating multiverse. It's hard to get away from it.
So this is something that you agree with. We found something that's contentious that you agree with, and we can't directly test whether
or
not
contentious. But I think if you think about inflation, it's hard to imagine an inflationary model that isn't eternal, and that does therefore produce a multiverse. Now that doesn't always imply that the laws of physics are different in every pocket universe, as Alan Guth would call it, but it allows that possibility.
I think it's definitely contentious, maybe not in the cosmological circles, but that we live in a multiverse of this sort.
Where is it contentious? I think most physicists think it's the most likely possibility. Most physicists who thought about it. I think most physicists, most theoretical physicists who thought about it and know anything about inflation, think that's probably the most likely possibility.
And so one of the problems that you identified...
Well, that's good or bad. We may all be wrong, but I think I think you'd find more consensus than you might think.
One of the problems that you identified with string theory is that there aren't currently technologically feasible experimental methods to directly test or observe strings. But by that same token, we can't directly observe these other multiverses. So what is it theoretical or experimental data that leads you to believe, though you could be wrong, in their existence?
Look, I have proposed a way to find out if the other inflationary multiverses exist.
How's that?
It will indirectly give strong evidence they exist, just like Einstein's prediction of Brownian motion gave great indirect evidence that atoms exist. Couldn't see them directly, but everything about the observations was consistent and strongly, compellingly suggest atoms were real and not a mathematical icy, which in 1905 was a big issue. A lot of chemists thought atoms were also just a mathematical artifice. Anyway, so the idea is that if we observed gravitational waves from inflation, then two things, by the way, as I've shown with Frank Wilczek, in fact, but as we showed, it tells us that gravity is a quantum theory. There will be no gravitational waves from inflation if gravity isn't a quantum theory. You know, and it's up for grabs. I mean, many people like Atuf probably think that gravity isn't a quantum theory, that quantum mechanics is going to go out the window before general relativity. So that would be fascinating. It would show that gravity is a quantum theory. But you see, if you could find those gravitational waves, then you could actually measure parameters of inflation, if you wish. And then you'd have a model. And in those parameters, you'd say, is this an inflationary model that results in a multiverse? And if you've tested that, I mean, this is an ideal situation. But if you do that, then you say, okay, well, that's the model we've tested. And that's what happened. And therefore, there must, even though we can't see it, there must be a multiverse.
This,
so it's indirect evidence, just like the indirect evidence of atoms, in my opinion.
Yeah, this reminds me of getting back to where we started, Brian Keating's work trying to detect gravitational waves through
them, and they were trying to detect them and looked like they had, but they hadn't. Mm-hmm. Well, looked like they had, but it's not clear that we couldn't say they detected it. You can't there say they dust. Didn't. It was the noise is big enough that you couldn't tell it was a signal.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to end with something that I'm particularly curious about. You haven't spoken to Sam Harris on the show, have you?
Not on my podcast, no.
Not on your podcast? Okay, well.
And I don't, I think I was on his podcast, but he's had so many podcasts, I don't know which one I was on.
Yeah, but I am not sure which book it was in. I think it was from In a Universe from Nothing. But uh-huh. You wrote that just as religion hasn't helped us understand the way the world is with regard to science, as you just echoed a few minutes ago, I think you prophesized, maybe that's not the right word, that it will also be shown that religion wasn't at all helpful with regard to morality, and that science might help us better in this respect. And I imagine that the religion not helping us with morality, we can just point to God is not great to give us some great examples of that. But where do you think that we ought to derive our moral knowledge or our moral principles from?
Well,
if not something
like, use the right word, ought. I do think I do agree with Hume that you can't get ought from is, but I do think that science, and maybe empirical evidence and logic and strict logic and reason applied to empirical evidence, is the only way one can get a reasonable morality. And it does not everything. But without knowing what the implications of your actions are, you can't decide what actions are good. Now, does science tell you always which actions are good? No, but it can tell you. But it can tell you what the implications of your actions are. And a reasonable person using reason could decide that actions are bad based on that. So I think morality without science is impossible.
Okay, and this might be too philosophical for you, that's okay, but then does our notion of what good is that supposed to come from science as well, or your...
Well, you know, again, that, I mean, not unambiguously, but you can make rational arguments, and utilitarian philosophers like my friend Peter Singer would argue that you can look at the implications of actions, and one of the things you might say is that the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Or you can make a lot of arguments which are rational. And I don't know if you can, I don't think you can ever decide between them on the basis of the science alone, but you can at least produce alternatives that rational people can debate.
But I mean, just taking like a simple example, like it would be bad if I just hit my dog who's sitting right behind me. Is the reason that science would tell us this is bad is that if we hooked up a brain monitor to him or something, it would cause pain, and we've just decided that pain is bad?
That's one reason. There's a lot of arguments you can think of. You can show that it would cause pain, but is pain bad? You know, if you're a masochist, maybe it isn't. So you could argue that maybe pain isn't so bad, but you could also argue, if you're a dog, then dogs will become violent, and they won't be good pets, and they'll be dangerous, and therefore, you know, you can make all sorts of arguments for why it would lead to a society that's not as stable or happy. But at some level, it always comes down to things that I think are debatable, but reasonable people can debate and try and lead to. And try and use reason to convince oneself. So I think you can't get off from it, but you can get damn close. You can lead in the right direction.
Okay, well, I think that's a really good note to end. So again, Lawrence, thank you so much for your time. It's been really fun.